Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Yeah, Mark, we have been discussing a lot about COVID's impact on EB5 and especially on the economic side of things. And we've had previous podcasts where we've had economists as guests and we've asked them questions relating to COVID's impact, especially on the TEA. Now, there was some new data which was released on April 16, 2021. This data included all of the 2020 data. And I don't think anybody expected last year for us to have the effect that it's had.
You're right, Mona. We had three economists on that were trying to predict the future based on what they knew at the time. Well, now we have better information, clear information, more up-to-date information. So it makes sense to revisit the topic and find out what it means to us.
Right. We really want to make it clear. So we wanted to have one of the best professionals in the area who would discuss this.
And by one of the best professionals in the area, of course, Mona, you mean Jeff Carr. Jeff is president and senior economist of Economic and Policy Resources. And I'm sure many of our longtime listeners are familiar with Jeff because, honestly, Mona, whenever we have questions about economic analysis, job impacts, TEA designations, and what all this means, Jeff has always been kind enough to come on to our show and explain it to us. And it's not just us and our audience. I mean, Jeff also has been in front of Congress and explaining the economic impact of EB5 to Congress. And if he can explain it on Capitol Hill, well, surely he can do so for us in a way that we understand it. Jeff, welcome back to EB5 Investment Voice.
As always, I'm delighted to be back.
Jeff, it's always a pleasure to have a professional on the show like yourself who can really tell the audience what to expect. There has been a lot of discussion about this particular point, this question I'm about to pose to you. We did ask you last year, did you expect that the TEA designations would change as a result of COVID? And I think you said no.
Well, I think I said I didn't expect radical changes. In the TEA world, everything is a relative calculation. And by relative, I mean relative to the area that you're looking for in terms of trying to get a targeted employment area designation versus the national average. And of course, at the time, everyone was expecting that the pandemic, you know, we did a hard stop on the economy at that particular point in time when the cases really started to increase. And particularly in New York and some of the other areas, which are, I think, very important to the EB5 program. And we thought that, well, since everything's relative, and we expect this to be short and, not so injurious.
Oh, yeah, I remember. We all thought that, right? We all thought it was going to be, we were at home for 3 weeks or 4 weeks.
and then we get back on course, and then the economy would move back to maybe where it was before the pandemic. Of course, that didn't happen. We ended up with losing 20 million payroll jobs in the U.S. economy over about an eight-week period, which is about two times the amount that we lost during the Great Recession back in late 2009 into 2010. So we had, at that particular point in time, about an 18 to 20-month slow-motion economic train wreck. And in response to COVID, this all happened in 8 weeks, in 2 months.
So to be clear to everybody, the new data, which was released on April the 16th, which has put everything in perspective, you did not expect the 2020 data to look like this. It really has impacted the TEAs, correct?
Well, it has. And I think it has because the virus has impacted different parts of the country and different parts of the economy in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you layer on top of that now that the stigma of remote working has, you know, been largely dissipated in response to the COVID pandemic, we have people that are working in New York from places like Vermont, upstate New York, Connecticut, you know, even into Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania now, the data have become a lot less continuous. And these data hate discontinuities. The whole estimating procedure, you know, from the raw survey results, smooth things out.
Well, what do analysts and economists do when something like this happens?
And when you have something like this that has selectively hit different parts of the economy harder than the others, for example, in higher paying services categories where people can stay home and telecommute in versus somebody who works in a restaurant where or in an amusement park or at some place where people have to go to that place in order to get what they are looking for, it's been a lot harder on the economics of place for people that are in the entertainment business and retail or in restaurant food service types of things and at resorts and at hotels and hospitality assets than it has for people who work in law offices, maybe in financial services, who have the ability to sit home and still telecommute in and use wonderful innovations like Zoom and Teams and GoToMeeting and all the other electronics that are out there. So we've had differential impacts, not only on different parts of the economy, harder on what I call virus sensitive parts of the economy versus the ones that are less virus sensitive. And if you are part of the region where your TEA is less sensitive to the virus in terms of its economic mix versus a part of the economy that's more sensitive to the economic impacts of the virus, like if you're in a travel and tourism center, all those things are going to move differentially. And so much of it depends upon, in terms of your TEA, like it always has been, on where you're located, but also now this has been magnified by the effect of this virus.
Right. So let's just take New York, for example, because I still feel that New York City and New York was one of the worst impacted in COVID, and we're still struggling to get back to normal. But now one of the biggest changes we've seen is that entire counties are qualifying as TEAs, and includes Queens and Brooklyn and Brooklyn County, Kings County and the Bronx and parts of Manhattan. It's great news for projects because some of these areas just did not qualify before after the 2019 regs were enacted. Do you see any other big developments in this area?
Well, I think it's always better news if larger areas of geographic space now qualify. Okay. Yeah. But what it's also going to do, the back end of that is what gives you the opportunity to be a TEA now because of these kind of huge movements and things. As the economy recovers and as more people get vaccinated and we get to the level of functional herd immunity, you have to be concerned that you could lose it just as fast as you've gotten it. So for people that are thinking about now moving on EB-5, even with the uncertainty surrounding the reauthorization of the regional center program, you almost need to move quickly before next mid-April when the next round of data come, because layered on top of all of what we were talking about the virus's differential impact on different parts of the economy, and different geographies around the country, the Labor Department is also having measurement issues with it.
Well, what's the Labor Department going to do with these issues?
They're going to fix those.
Okay. Optimistic.
And so the unemployment rate is going to probably move back to some kind of equilibrium at some point in time in a way which is going to be complicated not only by the underlying economic events,
but
also the kind of idiosyncrasies that are associated with the way that the Labor Department does its surveys and then actually calculate the rates. So we're going to be in a really big window of uncertainty on the stability of TEAs and what the outlook for TEAs is beyond what their reading is now. And, you know, that comes at a time now where you can't even get a letter from, you know, for a high unemployment rate TEA from a state agency anymore. We have to rely on the view of USCIS case officers once they get around to picking up the file.
Right. Well, there are other factors as well, I suppose. As you correctly say, you know, somewhere like New York City, it's such a high restaurant and hospitality sector that once that picks up, you're suggesting we are going to lose some of the TEAs that we've just got, right?
Well, we could. You know, it's also arts and entertainment capital and all those kinds of things. And so you always have to look at it with a critical eye and be concerned about that. I don't necessarily believe that ipso facto, as quickly as we gained it, we're going to lose it. It all depends upon how the recovery pans out and how, you know, the statistics that are calculated and surveyed by the U.S. Department of Labor pan out, because layered on top of this pandemic. It's not just COVID, but we have now from the federal government deficit spending dollars in the trillions raining down on the economy. And, you know, the last time we spent our way out of a serious economic hole, it was when we spent our way out of the Great Depression with World War II.
Well, how is that investment and spending of trades and professions stack up with the previous tanks and planes spending?
This amount of federal deficit spending exceeds what fueled our recovery from the Great Depression in the 1930s as a result of World War II spending on the war machine, so to speak, and the industries that supported the war effort. So this is, you know, on top of an unprecedented once in every 100 years pandemic, we have an equally unprecedented amount of federal deficit spending that has been thrown at the economy and has resulted in a bifurcated economy. Some parts of the economy, like the ones we talked about that are virus sensitive, have been very hard hit. And we're throwing the money at the lowest common denominator to try to help those parts of the economy. At the same time, there's a part of the economy that's continued to do well, has actually done better than what they would have done but for the pandemic. And now we're using the money to support them as well. And so, you know, we're kind of looking over the next 2 years in terms of the economics of things. Where we're going in this is laying the groundwork for one of the strongest periods of economic recovery / expansion coming up over the next 2 to 3 years. That's going to probably profoundly impact indicators in the economy, like the unemployment rate and how they move in the small geographies like the MSAs and the cities and the boroughs and the counties relative to the way that the national economy's unemployment rate goes overall is going to really have a profound impact on TEA determinations going forward.
So interesting. So interesting. But just to be sure, if somewhere from the last data, which is just released on April 16th, if a location is a TEA and we have a TEA designation, it's good for a year as far as EB-5 is concerned, correct?
Calculations-wise, yes, it's good till the next update of the unemployment data that come out in April of 2022. It's good until then. And I think projects have to be concerned that, you know, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. Move forward as quickly as you can because you could lose it as quickly as you got it.
Jeff, are there opportunities for projects that may have been in a TEA before the whole EB-5 restructuring pre-COVID that have since lost their TEA status, or those that maybe never had it? Is there opportunities for those projects to quickly claim TEA status and grab some investors?
There always is situations where that happened because the TEA determinations are driven locally relative to a national change. And at the same time, some of our projects we know already, as they've gone through this because of their differential economic structure and how they were affected by the virus and how they're being impacted by the federal deficit spending that's raining down on the economy, they've lost TEA determinations that they had prior to the pandemic.
So
it's a mixed bag, and it goes, it just depends upon what the specific location of a project or a potential project is and how that moves differentially against the U.S. unemployment rate. And when the rate jumps like it did, you know, it went up to 14.7% back in March and April timeframe. And just remember, we have to go 150% of the U.S. change. So if the unemployment rate goes up 5 or 6 or 7 points or something like that, we got to go up 150% of that in order to qualify.
Jeff, as the data has changed and TEAs have changed, you know, a lot of product developers and clients, et cetera, they're looking out on all of these maps that have suddenly sprung up all over the internet, the do-it-yourself TEAs, we call it. And I know there are some tricks to the TEAs, the TEA map, but is that the right way? Should we encourage people out there to go to the do-it-yourself maps to determine if their project location isn't actually in a TEA? Do they work?
Well, I mean, I've seen them and, you know, I've actually played around with one or two just to see how they worked. And I think that they can perform a role for people who are thinking about doing an EB-5 project or have an EB-5 project and are concerned about the TEA status from the standpoint of doing an initial screening. Just remember, you know, most of the maps use only one of the ways that you can one way or the other, and there's several different ways you can do a TEA. So just because it works with a map, it's a pretty good indication that there's a way to do this, and you're still going to need a TEA opinion letter to be submitted to the USCIS case officer whenever anybody files a petition. And then I've also heard our work, you know, in that regard, where we do an opinion letter on a TEA, it's called an investor comfort letter.
Oh, I like that. An investor comfort letter. Sounds Mark, cozy. Have you heard that?
And so obviously we're in the business of doing that. Uh-huh. You know, because you still need a TEA opinion letter, it's a good thing to go out and, you know, say, oh, I think I might qualify based on this tool. But you can't go to the USCIS with those results. You still need to have a formal opinion, and you still have to have a transparent presentation of why and how, and it has to conform to the TEA regulations of the day, which now are November 2019 based. And so, I mean, listeners should remember, and this is not the fault of the people that have the TEA maps, but they're basically marketing tools to get you interested in speaking with them. And to give, they give you a little something that they can put into a mathematical algorithm, and, you know, within a standard software package to get your attention and get you to talk to them. But you still need the professional opinion, and you still need the transparent presentation. So they're worthwhile, and they don't cover all the different ways you can do it. And that's why you need to come to, I think, to somebody like me. You know, there's a bunch of people out in the space that do these TEA calculations and opinion letters. And you still really need to verify it with that. And you still obviously need to have the documentation to support a TEA determination by the USCIS case officer.
Jeff, do you think those online TEA maps are useless? Do they provide any benefit at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think they work really well as a general rule for single, you know, census tract or single area TEAs.
Yeah, we think that as well.
What they don't do well is if you've got to evaluate whether or not you can do the ring of contiguous geographic space around them for like census tracts or something like that, it's much harder to construct a TEA if you've got to do something outside of a straightforward one or two, you know, census tract, a high unemployment rate targeted employment area.
Right. So there's often a case, Jeff, and you know it and I know it, where we have a project which is a half TEA. It's on a TEA and it's not on a TEA, or it's adjacent to a TEA. And what you're saying is that we don't really recommend those maps in those situations. You really recommend doing other things?
Well, I think, you know, whenever you consider making an investor filing with an I-526 petition or an exemplar 924 amendment, you need to have full documentation and transparent documentation that these tools don't provide.
Yeah.
And if you get any outside anything other than the ordinary single, you know, geographic area kind of view, you know, even if you go sub county or sub MSA or sub municipal level and get into census tracts, you still need the transparency, and you still need to have somebody look at the data and look at the range of possibilities, because you don't want to get into a situation where if it doesn't show on the map as being something that qualifies for a TEA, that you don't want to have a false negative, that there really is an option, that if you get beyond, you know, the opaqueness of the TEA mapping tools and get into looking at all the data sets, you know, for the census tracts, for example, that would surround the place, the location of your particular project, you want to make sure that you look and exhaust all the possibilities in that, because first of all, you don't want to be in a situation where the TEA map says yes, and it turns out that it really isn't, which is relatively low, but you still got to check it. But I think the biggest risk for people that use the mapping tools is you run the risk of having a false negative, whereas it doesn't look like it works on the map, and then you go off and do other things and think your EB5 project isn't going to have a TEA, so you're maybe not that interested in it anymore.
Well, Jeff, let me jump in and ask a little bit about these false negatives. Is there, a different range of possibilities with TEA designations that now exist because of COVID? Has there been like almost a targeted employment area inversion? Because before, people worked in metro areas like New York City and lived in the burbs. Well, now people are living in the burbs and big metros are suffering. Is something like that happening? And if it is, or if it isn't, what are some of the things that economists like you, what are you thinking about when you put these range of possibilities together to avoid those false negatives?
Well, I mean, you know, we're data people, so we look at the data sets. And a lot of times when you look at data, you've got to understand how it might be correct, but also how it might not be correct. And these data sets generally are stable. Generally, TEA's data, whether national or on the local side, move rather glacially. What we're talking about, I think, that what's developed since, you know, over the last 18 months or so now, is as we got to the end of the upturn and then got into the COVID pandemic, is that there have been some major shifts in where people work and those types of things. Mm-hmm. And the unemployment rate is who is employed by where they live. And so in many respects, remote working, you know, has changed the location of the job, but hasn't changed particularly their place of residence. But at the same time, there have been people who have left the cities and moved out to rural areas and things like that. So they've changed their place of residence. And to the degree in which that has occurred, which is, I think, is more significant than it in a short period of time than has been the past over the last 40 years, that has a real capability of affecting how these numbers are going. And that may be explain some of the things that Mona and her team have been seeing in that whole MSAs and whole counties now are qualifying as TEAs, because now we're measuring people who are working or not working, who have moved out of the cities to get to places where maybe the threat of becoming sick with COVID wasn't as great. And that's been a very dramatic shift that we're just now seeing in some of the census numbers that came out this week.
So this brings on my next question, Jeff, and this is what we are also seeing. Businesses have bifurcated. They've increased their employment, but many of the employees are now working from their homes, so they're not working from the place of work. So how does that affect the entire TEA tract for a project? If the employment, for example, is coming from one business, which is in a TEA, but then all the employees and much of what they're doing is not in a TEA because they're now working from home.
Well, the unemployment rate numbers are driven by people who have a job by where they live to begin with. So the fact that they're telecommuting now isn't going to have a big impact because unless they've moved, they're going to be counted identically had they been, you know, even though they were commuting to work, they were counted in the unemployment rate data survey based on where they live. It's employed residents by place of work. But if they've moved, in other words, if they had a job in New York, lived in northern New Jersey, but decided that they were going to move to the Adirondack Park in upstate New York, that could have an impact because they would be counted as being employed, even though they still had their job in the city, but they would be counted as being employed as being in upstate New York, maybe around Albany or you know, in that kind of an area. And they would be no longer counted as being employed in northern New Jersey because that's where they live.
And there could be more of that because of people before they wanted to live close to work to decrease a commute. Now, since they're working more from home, exactly. They want to work somewhere where they enjoy working, a better home perhaps. Yep.
Well, don't you also take the commuter patterns into account when you're calculating your job data?
Well, yes, we do that in terms of when it was, we were able to do a targeted employment area that included just the small areas right around where the project was located.
Right.
For example, a lot of folks in the earlier days prior to November 2019 said, how can the project in Lower Manhattan be a function of the TEA? Well, it's the function of where the workers came to work in Lower Manhattan, not the function, not the function of the actual place of the project. We took into account and built the area based on the commuter shed where the workers that ended up in Lower Manhattan were. And we were able to do that and able to make the case and able to work with the state departments of labor to do that prior to the November 2019 changes.
But since then, that ability has gone away.
It's gone away. If we use a sub-municipal area like a census tract, we can only use in the calculation of the unemployment rate the census tracts that touch the census tract where the project is specifically located. So we're missing a lot of people who could be workers that could be coming into the project's area.
Jeff, you've been doing this many years. What do you think? Do you think USCIS are going to have an element of discretion here because there is so much up in the air?
Well, they'll have very limited discretion, you know, because the 2019 regulations are pretty specific. You can only count a limited number of sub-municipal areas called census tracts that are touching the census tract where the project is located. The only discretion they'll have is whether or not they are offended or they approve of a census tract that's brought into a multiple census tract calculation that touches the census tract with the project. You know, in other words, it doesn't work with a project with a census tract where the project is located, but if we bring in three census tracts that touch it, then they'll, you know, they'll opine on whether or not that's reasonable to do. And as long as it's within the context of the 2019 regs, they should say okay. But, you know, maybe some case officer will say, well, we're only going to allow you to bring one in, not three. They don't have that discretion the way I read the regulations. And if you appealed it, you should win because you're able to do that via the regs. And so there's always some discretion the case officers have on lots of things. But it seems to me on targeted employment area designation for high unemployment rate targeted employment areas, they have less than they would have, say, over a source of funds or some issue about whether or not you're within the reasonable time that you have, for example, to create jobs beyond the filing of the I-829 petition.
Wow, this is an amazing update, Jeff. Thank you.
Jeff, with all these recent changes in the economic impact of the U.S., as well as the TA designations and everything, who should really be on the lookout to maybe not take advantage, but be aware of these changes and perhaps use those changes to their best benefit? Who are the people that should really be acting on today's info? And then what should they do?
Well, I think everybody who is either in the process of fundraising, who anticipates fundraising, or people who maybe have a project that they're thinking about, owe it to themselves to get the best technical assistance through a qualified immigration counsel like Mona and her team, and someone who is an economist who understands these data, who understands the flow of these data, how they're measured, how they could change going forward, and, you know, talk to you about, you know, the risks associated with going in this direction, but also the rewards associated with this kind of determination once you're there and you're able to secure it. And then in the reward period, how long is that potential reward period going to continue, which will govern your ability to fundraise at the targeted employment minimum investment amount?
Yeah, you mean the window is closed. The window will close soon.
Well, it could. And so, and particularly now, because as I said earlier, these statistics don't like wide swings. They tend to move glacially. And so as they've swung wide towards accommodating more projects, you also have to be concerned about them swinging, the pendulum swinging back in the opposite direction, which maybe would not be so friendly to your project.
Well, there you have it, folks. It sounds like if you're a regional center or a developer, you need to understand what's changing with the TEAs and work it to your benefit. And if you're an investor and you've got this question and you ask that of your regional center and developer and they don't know what you're talking about, maybe that's a sign. So regional centers, developers, definitely be on top of this. Jeff Carr, thank you once again for coming back on EB5 Investment Voice.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.